stepped away from the fire. What is it this time? Did somebody forget to turn the stove off before we left? Man, I was hoping whatever the problem was, it was simple. It's not like I can go back up there and fix it, Skippy. The stove is not a problem, since I already mentioned that the ship currently does not have a galley. I'm working on that. Anywho, to be serious for a moment, Joe, one of the drop ships had a slight accident. Slight? Like you scratched the paint or dented the fender? No, slight like a gas pocket on a moon exploded when I drilled into it. The dropship flipped over and now it's stuck in a hole. What the hell, Skippy? Damn it, I leave you nice toys to play with and you break them. I can't trust you with anything valuable up there. Hey, to be fair, I'm working almost blind up here. That moon contained materials I need, and its orbit currently has it on the other side of the planet. I was using the dropship's crappy sensors to see what I was doing. The sensors didn't detect the gas pocket because the Theranin, here's a real shocker for you, didn't design their dropships to be used as drilling rigs. Anyway, I have another dropship on the scene, and I'm using combots to dig the first dropship out. It should be fine, except we'll need a new one, because the cabin got kind of crushed and it won't hold air pressure anymore. Also, I wouldn't try flying it down through an atmosphere at this point. The heat shield is not in good shape. Bluff it for me, Skippy, okay? What? Bottom line up front. Bluff. Tell me the important stuff first. Come on. You know U.S. military slang. Oh, yeah. All right. The bottom line is this little accident will add a week, maybe more, to the schedule. Most likely 16 days. I have to divert resources to recover and repair the dropship, and while I'm doing that, the dropship won't be mining ore for me. While I'm fixing that busted dropship, I will still be working on the Dutchman. However, work on the ship will be delayed. There is no way around it before you ask me some stupid questions. This was always a substantial risk, Joe. My original estimate had likely delays built into the schedule, so this delay only adds 8 days to when I expect the ship to be functional again. I sighed. Understood, Skippy. You're doing the impossible up there. We appreciate it. And I won't insult you by telling you to be careful. Indeed, you do not need to tell me to be careful. I'm working on the edge here already, Joe. It would not take much to tip the scales, so that I'm using up resources faster than I'm creating new ones. You won't let that happen, right? I asked hopefully. I'm doing my best. What scared me was his voice didn't have the usual snarky cockiness to it. He was scared, or at least very concerned. And from Newark, there was absolutely nothing we could do about it. Skippy's pizza delivery had soft-landed in a swampy area. We had to wade through bone-chilling water up to our waists to get to it. Part of me was wondering if Skippy had done that on purpose, although I'm sure he had done the best he could from the other side of the star system. By the time we got through the icy water to the package, I couldn't feel my legs, or my balls. The container was roughly twice the size of a large footlocker. It was jammed, packed, partly with medical supplies we might need after the assault. Most of it was food. A sort of food. It was dehydrated sludges. All of it. What the assault team needed was basic nutrition, not gourmet food. We got the container back to dry land and popped it open. Soldiers began pulling out the contents and laying it out on the ground for sorting. Chocolate banana, plain banana, strawberry banana, banana curry. Sir, most of these are some type of banana flavor, Williams announced in consternation. Oh, crap, I slapped my forehead. Skippy thinks monkeys love bananas. I groaned, frustrated. If we get another delivery, I'll request a better variety of flavors. Captain Gomez uncapped a sludge, poured water in to rehydrate it, shook it up, and drained it in one gulp. Food is fuel, he shrugged. We can eat real food when we get back to the Flying Dutchman. Right. Everyone, I reminded people. We bury our trash. Can't have a Kristang ship seeing empty sludge packets lying on the ground. And let's drag the empty container into water deep enough that it will sink. Put some rocks in to make sure. To set an example, I picked up a sludge packet without checking the flavor, poured water in, and gulped it down. It was maybe supposed to be plain banana flavor. You couldn't quite tell with Theranin sludges. Most of them had a nasty, artificial taste. When we got the sludge supply back out of the swamp and unpacked, we divided them up evenly. Does everyone have real food left? I asked Smythe quietly. I think so, sir. Everyone ate a good breakfast this morning. I saw that. I've been watching people for signs of fatigue, nagging injuries, and that no one was skimping on nutrition. I have 8 MREs left. I'm going to save them for anyone who is wounded. Sir? Captain, I've survived on sludges before. It's not new to me. They provide energy, and they will sustain you. You will also get heartily sick of drinking them very quickly. If anyone is wounded out here, it's going to be quite some time before they can get full medical treatment aboard the Dutchman. I'd like them to have at least real food to eat. Keep their spirits up.
Oh, good thinking, he agreed.
I'll get a bag together. Smythe put an empty bag on the ground, and I asked people to donate one real food item, explaining that the bag would be reserved for injured soldiers or to be rationed out as treats after the battle while we waited for Skippy to fix the Dutchman. I have 8 incredibly delicious MREs here, I said as I held them up for view. 5 American, 2 French. I nodded to Giraud, who had traded with me earlier. And, I peered at the wrapper, I guess this one is Chinese. I'll start the kitty by donating all of them. I'm tired of carrying the damn things anyway. That drew a chuckle, and I put the MREs in the bag. 1 only, if you have it to spare. Keep the rest for yourself. Trust me, you are going to get very tired of existing on nothing but sludges.
He speaks the truth, Giraud testified, sticking his tongue out disgustedly, and we bumped fists.
Neither of us wanted to remember that unpleasant aspect of our first time aboard the Flying Dutchman. We got a good donation, and the bag then held 35 real meals of various types. None of it could be considered yummy. All of it had to taste better than a sludge. Smythe switched off the duties of carrying the goodie bag between soldiers, and we were extra super careful with it while crossing streams. I noticed that for the next 4 days, no one that I could see ate anything except sludges. Our shared suffering in that regard was a bonding experience. To spare the inexperienced the worst of the ordeal, I falsely let it be known that I didn't mind the plain banana flavor, which actually was among the very worst of the sludges. The plain banana, unmasked by other less unpleasant flavors like chocolate, strawberry, or even curry, was just bland, artificial, gritty, and had an oily mouthfeel that lingered nastily on your tongue. It was my fault for not requesting a better variety of flavors from Skippy. Although now that I thought about it, there hadn't been a whole lot of sludges left aboard the Dutchman when we began the second voyage, and no one had thought to request Skippy to make more. No one. Like me. Since no one liked the banana flavors, maybe Skippy had sent us whatever he had left over from the first voyage. That was doubly my fault. Either way, I ended up with nothing but dehydrated plain banana sludges, having traded away all the less nasty flavors. Every sip of oily, gritty, bland sludge reminded me about the value of planning ahead. This is certainly a lesson I wasn't going to forget. All I can say is, when we finally got back aboard the rebuilt Flying Dutchman, I was going to eat delicious, juicy cheeseburgers for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, every day the first week. Even if we no longer had a galley, and I had to grill the burger over a reactor. When we'd collected the real food, I selected a sludge at random from my pack, popped the cap, and poured water in to rehydrate it. Drink up, everyone. Enjoy your yummy sludge. And hey, today is Friday. Only 2 more working days until Monday. Despite how tired I was that night, I walked away from the campsite in order to talk to Skippy in private. While I told myself that I wanted to thank him for the food, I had to admit that I missed talking with his irascible self. No one had insulted me for several days. It felt weird. "Hey, Skippy, how you doing up there?"
"Busy," he said tersely.
"Oh," I said, feeling awkward. "Sorry. I'll leave you alone then." "No need, Joe. I'm not that busy." At the moment, I am in the extremely delicate process of creating exotic matter in what used to be one of our cargo holds, using basically a coffee pot, a missile warhead, and 2 combats that, despite my best effort at modifications, absolutely suck at anything but combat. If this goes south, even on Newark, you'll need to shield your eyes from the explosion. Don't worry, I am very confident. Fairly confident. Somewhat confident. Okay, yes, I'm making this shit up as I go, all right? Give me a freaking break. And I wouldn't be too hopeful about the ultimate fate of that coffee pot, in case you were wondering. However, carrying on an intelligent conversation with one of you monkeys takes up like 1 octillionth of my brain power, and half that when I'm speaking with you, so what's up? There was the Skippy I knew.
Simply wanted to say, sincerely from the bottom of my stomach, thank you for the food delivery. I was going to throw in free breadsticks, but, you know, what used to be the galley is currently highly radioactive, so that was not an option. We appreciate the thought, Skippy. Right then, I couldn't think of anything else to say. Yeah, you're welcome. No problem. He sounded like he felt the conversation was lagging, too. Before it got any more awkward, I said, Well, I'll let you go. How did the day go? I've been tracking your progress. Your group is making impressive progress. It seemed Skippy wanted to keep talking. Well, we didn't roll or sink an RV today. That's progress. Everyone here is sore, not that the Spec Ops people will admit it. Our muscles have adjusted to the extra gravity, our joints and tendons are slower catching up to the extra strain. I stepped in a hole and twisted an ankle yesterday morning. Did you talk to one of the doctors about it? No, I taped it up myself. He sighed. Joe, you brought two civilians with you to have doctors on the team. You're making them walk all this way for nothing? Skippy, they didn't come with us for something as simple as someone tweaking an ankle. They're here to take care of combat injuries. There's not much to be done other than taping my ankle. I can't stop walking. I don't want to waste their time, and I don't want Spec Ops people to think I'm weak. Joe, Joe, Joe. Once in a great while, you have a good idea. The rest of the time you are dumb as a rock. Surely you are not the only monkey in your party with an injury that is being either ignored or attended to amateurishly. Probably not. I thought of the various people I saw moving around stiffly in the mornings. And by not seeking the best treatment available, they risk becoming combat ineffective. As the commander, shouldn't you be setting an example? Crap. Skippy, you not only can build a starship out of moon dust, you know more about monkey, damn it, human psychology than I do. I should know that. You're right. I will talk to one of the doctors tonight. And soon, before they fall asleep. That's enough about me. How are you doing? Good enough. I've been monitoring the progress of the archaeology team. They have found a new chamber behind a wall. It was buried in a rock fall, perhaps at the same time when the main part of the cavern washed away and the roof collapsed. Anticipating your question, Colonel Chang is making certain they are being safe and not taking unnecessary risks with the project. The team is very excited. They haven't told you about it yet. They have found fragments of bronze plates with what appears to be writing. Colonel Chang hopes to find more writing samples buried further down. This new chamber overall is shallow. Whatever is in there will not require a deep excavation. Wow. Writing. Well, that's awesome. Don't get your hopes up, Joe. This writing, if that's what it is, looks like nothing but scribbles. The only way we will ever be able to read any of it is if we find more samples, a lot more, with pictographs. We can hope, though. How are things going with you up there? Good. Good enough. No new setbacks to report. While I have you, Joe, I've been thinking about that favor you asked. Huh? What favor? He already delivered the pizza. The favor about you and me riding off into the sunset together. Remember? You're studying up on how to fly the ship, so the two of us can drop the crew off at Earth after I contact the Collective. Oh, yeah. I tried to keep the hopefulness out of my voice. I thought about it, and I can see why you think it's a good idea. I am willing to give it a shot. Unfortunately, my analysis has determined the scenario is extremely unlikely. As you know, my memory is vague concerning the Collective. One thing I am certain about is that once I make contact, I will no longer be able to help you. I might not even be able to communicate with you in any way. I may, very suddenly, simply be gone. Oh, I hear you, Skippy. Thanks for telling me. Sorry. Skippy, you saved our entire home planet. You have nothing to apologize about. We all knew the risks when we came out here. I'm going to... I yawned. Talk to one of the doctors about my ankle. You have a good night, okay? You too, Joe. Sleep well. From the pizza delivery site, we had two solid days of walking over rolling hills in a steady, cold, dreary rain with wind blowing straight in our faces. For meals, we had cold, rehydrated sludges. At night, we collapsed in our tents and sleeping bags with wet clothes hanging on a line from the tent roof, dripping on us all night. In the morning, we got up and did it all again. The novelty of walking across an alien landscape, being the first humans wherever we went, was wearing off. Every single one of us wanted to get to the scavenger base, get the attack over with, and get back aboard the Flying Dutchman. Apparently I had earned a measure of grudging respect from Smythe. He had taken to walking with me once I had demonstrated that I could keep up the pace. And I could, simply by concentrating on putting one foot in front of the other, hour after hour, day after day. What I could not do very well would be to carry a heavy pack all day in 14% higher gravity and oxygen equivalent to high altitude on Earth, and then go directly into combat. The Spec Ops people could. They'd trained for it, mentally prepared for it. At the end of the day, all I wanted to do was gulp down a nutritious sludge and sleep. A swirling gust of wind blew fat, cold raindrops right into my eyes. I wiped my eyes and lowered goggles from atop my head to protect from the stinging spray. They were fancy high-tech Cristang goggles that repelled water and didn't fog up inside. Even so, they were goggles, and wearing them constantly grew tiresome after a while. "Lovely weather here, Captain," I said to Smythe, who had put his own goggles on. "Is this what Scotland is like?"
"No." Smythe looked surprised at my question. "Scotland is ruggedly beautiful, most times of the year. If you like the outdoors, it's a wonderful place. It is mostly open country like this." He swept his arm across the eastern horizon, partly obscured by rain and low clouds. "And it can be wet," he admitted. "No more so than the rest of the island, of course."
It took me a moment to realize that by the island he meant Britain. As an American, I thought of Britain first as a country, not an island. When I hear the term island, I think of someplace tropical with palm trees and coconuts, and tropical drinks, with little umbrellas, and slices of pineapple.
"That's where you train? The SAS? In Scotland?"
"Scotland? Sometimes. 22 SAS is based in Hereford near the Welsh border. Part of our selection training takes place in the Brecon Beacons of Wales. That area is somewhat similar to this here. The weather can be very unpredictable, with wind coming off the Irish Sea."
"That's one advantage of Newark, I suppose. The weather here is predictable. Lousy all the time. My hometown in Maine can have bad weather. At least there the whole area is mostly covered with trees. It cuts the wind. And we have plenty of fuel for a campfire there."
"Have you ever been to Britain?" he asked. I shook my head. Smythe went on.
"You would like the walking trails in Britain. In the States, I understand that your walking trails are mostly in the woods, and you cook your meals over a fire and sleep in tents. In Britain, we have walking trails that go from one village to the next. You can stop at a pub for lunch and dinner and stay in a guest house overnight. It's very popular, particularly in areas such as the Cotswolds and the Yorkshire Dales."
"That sure sounds tempting right about now."
"The trails go right into a village?"
"Yes. The difference is," Smythe explained, "most of your trails in the States were set up by governments on public land or on private land where the owner allows access. In Britain, the public has access across private lands because for thousands of years, peasants had right of access to get water, to drive their animals to market or to pasture. The current landowners can't block the public from walking across their land because of the historical right of access. There is a group which organizes what they call a mass trespass once a year, to walk all the trails in Britain in order to maintain the public's right of access."
"Huh," I said. "Man, that would piss off a lot of people back home.
America hasn't been around for long, compared to Britain. Different standards," Smythe concluded.
We stopped talking after that as the path took us up a long, steep hill, and I couldn't manage more than grunts. Even Smythe appeared winded from the climb. We paused at the summit.
"The mountains of Afghanistan are like this. At altitude, you get to the top of a climb," he said, gasping. "And you want to catch your breath, but you can't."
I nodded. "I was with the 10th Infantry Division. The 10th used to specialize in mountain warfare. Then they sent me to the jungles of Nigeria, and then to Paradise. The first place I was stationed on, Paradise, was so flat, it looked like Kansas."
The rain stopped in mid-morning the next day. There was a strong, constant wind from the southeast this time that seemed to literally blow the clouds away. By early afternoon, the wind dropped to a pleasant breeze, the sun came out, and the temperature soared high enough that I stripped down to a long-sleeved shirt. People's spirits rose with the temperature, grim faces replaced by grins, grunts replaced by laughter. Taking advantage of the break in the weather, I unrolled my damp sleeping bag, turned it inside out, and tied it to my pack so it could dry.
Also, I hung wet socks from my belt. Everyone did something similar. The sunshine on my face actually felt warm, even a little hot at times. Captain, I said to Smythe, Skippy tells me this nice weather is going to last until around midnight, then we're getting rain showers. We're still ahead of schedule. I want a 2-hour break for lunch. We'll get the tent set up with flaps open so they can dry out, and we can string clotheslines from those rocks over there. We will walk a bit later into the night to make up the time. The ground ahead is pretty flat, and there's no large streams to cross until tomorrow. To my surprise, Smythe didn't protest the delay. We got tents and clotheslines set up quickly, and we all took a nice break in the sunshine, sitting or laying on dry rocks. It's not so bad now, I mused to Tanaka and Jeng. We were sitting on a flat rock with our boots and socks off, rubbing our feet. The two civilians had held up very well to the rigors of our grueling hike across Newark. You know, I wonder what this area was like before.
Before?
Jeng asked. And before Newark got pushed out of its original orbit, I explained. We're 700 kilometers from the equator here. This must have been what? Jungle? Desert? Something hot. People, the natives, they might have come here on vacation.
I don't think their society had vacations. They probably didn't have the technology for leisure travel, Tanaka said.
They had the wheel. That means roads, I pointed out defensively. Anyway, you know what I mean. This was a nice place back then. I looked around at the low rolling hills, valleys crisscrossed by streams that sparkled in the sunlight. Like that hill over there, I pointed to the south. It has a nice view of that lake. It would have had nice breezes for cooling. I wonder if anyone lived up here. Zhang shaded her eyes and looked around. I couldn't tell whether she was irritated that I disturbed the rest she'd earned.
Most of this landscape was carved by glaciers when Newark was frozen solid before the orbit became elliptical. That lake, even that hill, may not have existed back then. That will be a big problem for archaeologists. Much of the evidence of civilization here, cities, buildings, roads, like you said, will have been scoured away by glaciers. The glaciers, even here, could have been substantial. The science team is having a debate over whether Newark's surface froze completely over or whether there might have been a strip of open ocean near the equator during summers.
Perhaps because she saw the crestfallen look on my face, she quickly added,
The natives didn't deserve what happened to this planet. No one does.
Except maybe the people who did this. What are the odds Newark is the only planet they threw out of orbit? I asked bitterly. My nice sunny good mood was fading. If I ever find those MFers...
Colonel, Zhang said and tapped my shoulder gently. We have a nice day here. A nice afternoon. Let's enjoy it while it lasts, okay? Enjoy it for the natives, because they can't. No more talk about glaciers, I promise.
Not thinking about glaciers for a while was nice.
Uh-oh, Joe, Skippy called me while I was wading across an icy cold stream that was up to my chest. Making the situation extra special was that because the water was deep, I had to make 2 trips across. It took 2 trips to carry all my gear high over my head so it wouldn't get wet.
Give me a minute, Skippy, I said with almost a gasp. The cold was taking my breath away. Of course, he called when I was in the deepest part of the stream.
Kind of busy here right now.
No immediate rush, Joe, he responded with a peevish tone. When I got to dry land, I set my gear down on a rock. On top of me being soaking wet from wading the stream twice, it was raining. It was always freaking raining on Newark. Following the example of the Spec Ops people, I did squats with my rifle over my head, then dropped and did 50 push-ups to get some warm blood into my chilled muscles. There were only 5 people still in the process of crossing the stream, and they didn't need my help, so I turned my attention to our annoying AI.
What is it, Skippy?
A potential problem, Joe? A few minutes ago, I overheard the scavenger leaders talking. 2 of them are taking a group of laborers out in a truck to a site where they previously found parts of the Elder Starship buried in the ground. They are loading the truck now.
Damn it. That was the last thing we needed.
If the scavengers were in 2 places, we would need to plan and coordinate 2 simultaneous attacks. Depending how far the Kristang drove in their truck, it might take us a long time, walking night and day, to catch up with them.
Although we were still slightly ahead of schedule, we couldn't delay an attack for very long because we couldn't risk the Kristang ship arriving early and spoiling all our plans.
This Elder site they're driving to, how far is it from their base? And do you know if they're planning to stay there overnight?
They are planning to stay overnight, one night only. This particular site has been picked over pretty thoroughly, Joe. It is quite desperate of them to go back there, hoping they can dig up something of value. Without air transport or their RV, they can no longer travel far from their base. This limits them to sites within roughly 80 kilometers. The leaders know that an extended excursion away from the base would make them vulnerable to attack by their laborers. Without air power, the leaders are feeling very vulnerable. They're absolutely right to be concerned. Their workforce is extra unhappy with their leaders. They've lost both of their aircraft and their RV, and they let what they think was an extremely valuable Elder power tap get away. The Elder artifacts they have recovered so far are not valuable enough to pay much more than the costs of the expedition, so the laborers know there will not be much, if any, profits to be shared. The workforce is ripe for a violent mutiny, Joe.
That's good for us. Where is the Elder site they're going to? Can you show me on my Z-phone?
There is a map on your phone now.
Huh. Damn, that's almost between us and the scavenger base. Skippy had put a blinking dot for the Elder site on top of the map we used to guide us to the scavenger base. Our route passed within 20 kilometers of where the scavengers would be staying overnight.
Do you know the route that truck will be driving? I asked. And immediately a series of red dots appeared on the map, outlining the route the Kristang were planning to drive. The last 40 kilometers of their route overlapped the route we planned to walk.
It made sense. We were now approaching the scavenger base from the south, and there was only one good route that avoided going up and down hills all day. We would follow a river valley. The Kristang and their truck understandably planned to do the same thing.
Skippy, thank you. I need to think about this. We can watch their truck from the satellite feeds?
You won't normally be able to do that through the thick clouds you have overhead now. I'll add an icon on your maps so you can see where they are.
The truck is leaving the base right now. I assure you that no one aboard that truck is singing the Kristang version of 99 bottles of beer on the wall.
Joe, these lizards are not a crew of happy campers.
Got it. Thank you.
I went over to Smythe, who was checking that everyone was ready to move out. Move out quickly, before our half-frozen muscles stiffened up. Explaining the situation, I showed Smythe the map on his own Z-phone.
Bloody hell, he said. This complicates things somewhat, doesn't it?
Yes, I agreed.
Although, he mused, scratching his two-day growth of beard, it could be an opportunity.
That also, I agreed again.
I see this as more risk than opportunity.
For opportunity, you're thinking we can take out this excursion party of Kristang and steal the truck, then we ride it into their base compound and take them by surprise?
Essentially, yes.
It is tempting, surely.
That sort of plan depends on our spy in the sky intercepting communications from the excursion party, then faking signals from them.
Can Skippy do that, do you think, sir?
Captain, that would not be a problem for Skippy. The problem is the excursion party will be overnighting only 70 kilometers from the base. That close, they can use simple radio to communicate, not route the signal through a satellite. When they send signals through one of their satellites, Skippy can intercept and squelch or alter the signal. He can't do anything about radio transmissions through the air.
Bollocks, Smythe declared.
That's out then. Unless we take them all out at once, we risk cocking it up. The timing would be too dicey. Too many ways it could go pear-shaped in a hurry.
Yeah, I said, not completely sure of his British slang. I understood the basics.
How about this? We proceed to here. I pointed to the spot where the Kristang truck would intercept our planned walking route on their return journey. And we wait for them to go by. Then we can follow their truck. We can't go ahead of them. They'd see our footprints. And that river valley is the only practical way to get from here to their base, unless we go all around these hills, way to the east. I don't like that option.
As much as I hate to pass up this opportunity, sir, Smythe observed sourly,
we are not out here to defeat them in detail any longer. We already knocked out their air power. Now we need to hit them all at once.
Rubbish.
We'll need to explain to the lads why we're not hitting them.
Chapter 25.
The lads weren't the only ones who needed to be reminded not to shoot, as we watched the Cristang truck slowly lurch by a couple days later. Smythe, Giraud, I, and a few others lay belly down behind rocks on the reverse slope of a hill as the Cristang truck drove back down the river valley below us. It was tempting, almost too tempting a target. With our Cristang rifles, we could easily have knocked treads off the truck, then picked off the Cristang one by one. If the Cristang and the truck were the only ones on the planet, that would have been a viable plan. In reality, we had to watch silently as the truck passed our position. As an extra precaution, none of us had brought weapons to our observation post. I wasn't worried about someone losing discipline and firing off a shot. I was worried about a weapon discharging accidentally. Yeah, it was a small risk. It was also a risk we didn't need to take. The Cristang in their truck didn't know we were there, couldn't see us, were not a threat to us. Their truck reminded me of the U.S. Army's N-977 heavy truck, except instead of eight wheels, the Cristang truck had four flexible tires like our sunken RV. The cab had a flat front with large windows. Through my Z-phone camera, I could clearly see the two Cristang in the cab. Behind the cab was a canvas sort of cover. Two more Cristang were sitting with their legs hanging over the tailgate, looking very pissed off. When we first saw the truck rolling along beside the river, it was moving fairly quickly over flat ground. Now, right below us, the river made a series of lazy bends, and the truck had to slow down to splash across streams. Skippy told us that truck didn't have swim pontoons. It couldn't float like the RV had. It was just a truck with fancy treads. On a planet crisscrossed with rivers, swollen with snow and glacial melt, a vehicle that couldn't cross a significant body of water was severely limited in where it could go. That explained why the Cristang had chosen to go out to an Elder crash site they had already explored. There weren't many places they could go, now that we had destroyed their aircraft and RV. The truck was driving back over its own muddy tracks, returning to the base the same way it had come out. In several places along the river, there was only one place to go without driving through water deep enough to submerge it completely. It went through a stream, and I found myself holding my breath. The truck was submerged almost up to its hood, and the two Cristang in the back were now standing up, keeping their feet out of the icy water. Even from where we were hiding, I could faintly hear the truck's motors whining. One of the left treads spun freely, then caught, and the truck waddled up the other side of the stream. The truck stopped, the left door opened, and a Cristang got out to inspect the front left tread. Then the other Cristang in the front got out, and the two of them talked while pointing at the tread. One of the laborers in the back poked his head around the side, and the first Cristang pulled out a pistol and gestured for the laborer to get back in the truck. The two in the front kicked the tread, and clods of mud fell out. After peering at the tread a minute and discussing something, the two leaders got back in the cab, and the truck lurched back into motion. After a while, watching the truck drive on became dull, when it became clear the Cristang had no idea we were there, and only wanted to get back to their base. My attention wandered away from the truck to Captain Smythe. I wondered how many times and how many godforsaken places Smythe had done this exact same thing, lain in wait, observing an enemy, deciding when and how to strike. Within 10 minutes, the truck went out of sight around a bend in the river.
"Skippy said there are six of them in the truck," Smythe said quietly. "The most we could have taken out at one time were three. No go. It wouldn't have worked anyway. And we couldn't have walked all the way to where they camped overnight in time to hit them when they were sleeping," I added. "We stick with the original plan. Let that truck drive back to the base. Give it 20 minutes to get well ahead of us, and we'll go down there and follow it. We should be within striking distance of their base tonight."
The big unknown in my plan to assault the scavengers' base was whether we could get close enough to launch a surprise attack, or whether the Cristang would see us coming far away and prepare the defenses. If the Cristang had made even a minimal effort at external site security, such as scattering a few cameras around the base perimeter, they could have ruined all our plans. A couple cheap cameras were a simple precaution that could have forced us to fight a pitched battle against Cristang with equivalent technology, with them in prepared positions. While we marched toward the base, Smythe and I discussed how to approach the base from multiple directions, using one group as a decoy, before the main assault team swept in from another direction. Neither of us liked the odds of that plan succeeding. To my surprise and delight, back when I was dreaming up the overall plan against the scavengers, Skippy confirmed the scavengers had made zero effort at protecting their base from external threats. The leader's only concern was security inside their base. The only threat they foresaw was from their own forced laborers. The base inside the fence was riddled with cameras and other sensors, and doors were locked with codes that only three of the leaders had access to. On an uninhabited planet, a planet without land animals larger than a tiny insect, the leaders must have figured cameras outside the base were not necessary. They were wrong. After the scavengers saw from Skippy's fake satellite data that they weren't alone on the planet, that other Krestang had been there, had even shot down their air power, you would think the scavenger leaders would have done something, taken some steps to prevent hostile forces from sneaking up on their base. They did absolutely nothing. After seeing the fake satellite of the other Krestang having flown up into orbit and then jumping away, the scavenger leaders once again thought they were safe. Stupid civilians. That was great news for us. The day before we were scheduled to reach the base, I asked Skippy to confirm there were no cameras, motion detectors, or other sensors outside the base. He replied that as far as he could tell, and he was tapping into all their communications, there were no sensors of any kind outside the fence. As far as he could tell. That was the problem. While we could plan for the best, we had to account for the worst. It was a judgment call, and as the commander I had to make it. If there were in fact no cameras or sensors outside the fence line, we could wait until daylight to attack, because my plan relied on the Krestang being awake. If there were sensors of any kind outside the fence line, then it would be best for us to approach the base and launch the attack at night to catch the Krestang as off guard as possible. If I assumed there were no sensors and I was wrong, our daylight assault could get difficult very quickly. But if I assumed there were sensors and we launched a night assault instead of sticking to my original plan, I would needlessly be putting human lives at risk. What I decided on was a compromise. We approached the base from two directions at night. One team of six people came in from the east as a decoy force. Once they were within half a kilometer, the rest of us, including an alpha team of two men in armor suits, ran toward the base from the west. If we were detected, the base would sound an alarm and Skippy would tell us right away. At that point, we were committed to hit the base as fast and hard as we could. There was no going back. Nothing to go back to. If our night approach was not detected and we got to the ridge 200 meters west of the base, we would hide behind the ridge until daylight and implement my original plan. To my original plan, I added a silent prayer before we crossed the start line. We each took with us weapons, water, a sludge, and first aid kits. Our two actual qualified doctors remained at the start line with the rest of our equipment, a kilometer from the base, under a bluff. Part of my prayer was that we wouldn't need the doctors. The weather was cold, but clear that night. A local TV weatherman, Skippy, said skies would remain mostly clear until the following afternoon. I took that as a good omen. Unfortunately, I mentioned my thought of omens out loud while Skippy was listening, and was subjected to a scathing lecture about ignorant, superstitious monkeys. It's a good thing he didn't know I was also wearing my lucky underwear. Yeah, lucky underwear is a real thing. Skippy's intel was right. No alarm was sounded. We got to our initial hold position 200 meters from the base, spread out to give good coverage, and we lay prone on the ground behind a ridge that was maybe 5 meters tall at its highest point, just enough to give us cover. We set up Z-phones sticking just above the ridge as cameras and monitored the view from our own Z-phones. We waited throughout the night silently, communicating by hand signals. As dawn approached, lights came on inside the scavenger base, and Skippy told us the Krestang were engaged in mundane tasks such as eating breakfast, showering, and arguing with each other. In 2 hours, two of the leaders planned to go out to the Elder crash site with six laborers to resume digging. Once they were outside the base, there was a strong chance they would see us, so I launched Phase 3 of the plan. Phases 1 and 2 of my plan relied merely on the Krestang's strong desire to possess an Elder power tap and Skippy's ability to control the data feed through their satellites. Phases 1 and 2 did not require the Krestang to do anything specifically Krestang-like in nature. Any species would want an Elder power tap. Perhaps the fact that the scavengers were especially eager to grab it as soon as possible before the starship they were expecting could steal it and jump away was a particularly Krestang characteristic, but no species would leave such a valuable object laying exposed on the ground for long. Of course, they would send an aircraft to pick it up, And of course, after the aircraft crashed, they would send their remaining air power to get the power tap. Humans would have flown a dropship to the crash site out of concern for any survivors of the crash, or at least to investigate the cause of the crash. The Kristang likely wouldn't have cared about any of that. Probably they'd consider such actions a sign of weakness. No matter what their motivations, the Kristang had fallen for our traps, phases 1 and 2, that wiped out their air power advantage and reduced the Kristang we potentially had to fight by 11. I'd been hoping one or both of the air sorties the scavengers sent out would contain at least one powered armor suit to reduce the number of those we had to face. Sending an armored suit seemed to me to be a blindingly obvious part of any plan to pick up a priceless Elder artifact. Someone in armor could more quickly and easily reach the site in the rough terrain of the Canyonlands. Someone in armor could more easily, and more important, safely, bring the artifact back to the aircraft. Crossing freezing cold, fast-running streams, walking over broken rocks and smooth, wet, slippery muds, sliding through mud, would all be safer in a powered armor suit that had gyroscopes and computer-controlled stabilizers. Unfortunately, although the Kristang would probably have agreed with me about the wisdom and practicality of sending armor to pick up the Elder power tap, they had a uniquely Kristang factor to consider. They couldn't trust their forced labor with powered armor. Even one of the 6 high-ranking Kristang who had armor wouldn't risk being away from the base surrounded by forced labor. In the close confines of an aircraft or hemmed in by canyon walls, a Kristang in armor would lose much of the advantage of wearing armor and be vulnerable to a concentrated, planned attack. The result, which sucked for us humans, was no armor was in either of the aircraft. That meant the scavengers at their base had 4 functional sets of armor that we would have to deal with. Too many Kristang, 4 of whom would have armor against our human spec ops team, and we had only 2 sets of Kristang armor with us. Phase 3 of my plan was to deal with the scavengers' numerical and armor advantage, and the advantage they had of being in defensive positions. I had thought long and hard about how we could defeat the scavengers. That's a nice way of saying we needed to kill them, all of them. Because I couldn't think of any way for us not to kill them, given their advantages of numbers, technology, and being on the defensive, I decided the only solution was for us to outsource the job. We would get the Kristang to kill each other. That's why my plan relied on them being awake and up before we launched Phase 3. I contacted Skippy. "Hey, Skippy, you there?" "Of course. How's your back feeling, Joe?" "Better," I admitted, "now that my pack is lighter." My pack was lighter because I was no longer carrying a section of powered armor and because I'd eaten most of the food we started out with. Dehydrated sludges didn't weigh much, even in 14% higher gravity. The armored suits were now assembled and ready for use in combat. My hope, if my plan worked, was that we wouldn't need our Alpha team with 2 sets of armor for a while yet. "You ready for Phase 3? "More than ready. I'm eager to see if this works. It will be an interesting experiment in Kristang's social dynamics." "Uh-huh. Sure thing," I agreed. "Activate Phase 3 whenever you can." "Done. If you're right, we'll know pretty quickly." "Yep, that's what I hope. Let me know as soon as anything changes over there." Phase 3 was simple. It didn't involve any decoys, any manipulation of satellite data, any shooting down aircraft, or any elaborate cover-ups of human involvement. The essence of Phase 3 was that the truth shall set you free. Only in this case, the truth was being given to the Kristang forced laborers, and the you really being set free was the human assault force. Free, hopefully, from having to engage in a protracted firefight with the Kristang. The truth part of Phase 3 was, in fact, truth. What Skippy did was grant the forced laborers access to secure communications of the 6 Kristang leaders. Not 100% exactly what the leaders said to each other. Skippy spiced things up a bit to get the laborers' attention quickly. Skippy made the breakdown in communications security seem like a system glitch, and it took the laborers a while to notice, even longer to take advantage of their surprise access. The data they had access to was, in essence, all true. The food supply at the base was dwindling, and the 6 leaders planned to either kill or abandon their forced labor on Newark when the starship arrived. While maybe the laborers suspected that was going to happen anyway, getting smacked in the face with it certainly made them hoppin' mad. Anger is a useless emotion, until it can be channeled into action, and that was where the other data Skippy gave them access to came into play.
He gave them access to the base physical security systems, like the doors that kept the laborers locked in when they weren't working, and the doors in the entire base, including the high security area where the six leaders lived, and most especially, the locks to the armory building, where the leaders kept almost all the weapons, and three of the four work in armored suits. Sentient beings, whether they are human, Ruha, Gristang, or any other species in the Milky Way galaxy, tend to avoid risk and tend to hesitate when presented with new information, particularly when that new information makes them question things they previously believed. Fortunately, most groups of sentient beings have one or two members who do not hesitate, who take decisive action, and those dynamic individuals usually bring the group with them. In the case of the laborers, there were three Gristang who didn't hesitate, who boldly and angrily took action. These three Gristang were younger sons, who were not technically prisoners or slaves. They were younger sons of impoverished sub-clan families, who had volunteered to join the scavenger expedition in a desperate attempt to improve the fortunes of their families back home. These three felt especially betrayed that their leaders planned to abandon them on Newark with the criminals and slaves who made up most of the workforce. The first thing the three did was verify the access codes truly could open the door that kept them trapped in their de facto prison. When that door opened with a metallic click, they moved out immediately. The laborers knew their leaders were watching them, knew the leaders had seen the laborers becoming agitated and angrily arguing amongst themselves, and knew the leaders would be notified as soon as the door was unlocked without the leader's authorization. So as soon as that door opened, the three bold laborers moved quickly, and the others followed. The others followed because they knew their leaders would punish all the laborers equally for attempted rebellion, knew they faced death whether they actively participated in the mutiny or not. It was all or nothing, and such clarity is a great motivator. The entire group of laborers raced through the camp toward the armory while the six leaders hesitated, stunned, for crucial seconds. When the six leaders finally faced their shock and new reality and roused themselves to action, the first thing they did was argue amongst each other. The primary leader, the one who had funded the scavenger expedition, knew that only he and two others had codes to unlock the armory door, yet he could see on the security system display that the laborers were confidently racing toward the armory building and had already unlocked the gate to the electric fence that surrounded the armory. The primary leader instantly drew only one conclusion from what he was seeing. One of the other two Gristang with the codes had given them to the laborers in an attempt to take over the base and steal the precious Elder artifacts for himself. Accordingly, the primary leader took out of its holster the pistol he constantly kept on his belt and shot the other two. Now there were four leaders left, and one armor suit available in the primary leader's cabin. The other three functioning sets of armor were in the armory building. After killing two of his fellows, the primary leader, with his pistol pointed at the three others, backed into his personal cabin and locked himself in. He came out 4 minutes later in an armor suit and led his three fellows toward the armory. On the video screen, the leaders could see the laborers had reached the armory and had already unlocked the outer door. A minute later, as the leaders reached the fence that surrounded the armory, shots rang out from both sides. It was a chaotic, bloody mess, a pure firefight without any planning, tactics, or coordination. The primary leader charged directly toward the back door of the armory building. He must have known that if the laborers got the other suits on, it was game over. The other three leaders poured fire into the open doorway of the armory, cutting down laborers as they came out, firing blindly. The laborers' numbers began to tell as one of the leaders went down, and the other two pulled back around the corner of a building for cover. Three times, Smythe reminded the team not to fire, regardless how tempting the target was, and to keep down and out of sight. Our alpha team, the two men in suits, were particularly itching to get into the fight. Keeping our heads down was a good idea, not only so the Gristang didn't see us, but also because there were explosive-tipped rounds flying thick through the air all around the base. The leaders had a few heavier weapons, and explosions sent shrapnel everywhere. The laborers responded with improvised explosives they'd taken from the armory. When the fighting ended, there were only three Gristang left alive on the planet. Two leaders, wearing armor and hunkered down in their own building, likely still in shock and trying to decide what to do, one laborer, holed up in the armory building, holed up with the precious stash of Elder artifacts and a whole lot of explosives. Explosives he threatened to detonate if the leaders didn't take off their armor suits, come into the open, negotiate how to split the artifacts, and assure the laborer he would be getting safely off the planet.
According to Skippy, he actually did have a chance to survive. Though Krustank society would not be happy about him participating in a violent mutiny, they would respect his courage, and more importantly, his success. The Krustang rewarded success in combat. I knew that from very personal experience. Unfortunately for him, we knew from Skippy listening in on the two leaders' conversations that they planned to betray and kill the laborer. We needed to deal with the three remaining Krustang. To put it simply, we needed to kill them quickly, and with minimal risk to ourselves. By ourselves, I mean the Spec Ops troops, not me. I didn't even have a weapon. What I had carried across the surface of Newark was ammo and part of an armor suit. Yes, I had experience in combat. I'd even killed Krustang. With the Spec Ops teams, I could only get in their way. Each team of four or six had trained extensively with each other, knew their tactics, knew each other, knew their roles, knew what every other member of the team would do in a situation. Each team had trained with other teams, and each soldier had cross-trained with other teams. Rangers had taken a place on the Chinese team, Chinese with the SAS, French paratroopers with the Indian counterparts. Although I had participated in some of the training aboard and outside the Dutchman, I wasn't qualified to go into combat with them.
"What do you think?" I asked Smythe. "It would help if we could draw those two leaders out of cover," Smythe mused. "Going to be a hell of a firefight if we have to go in there after them. Two armored suits against two armored suits, and they're bigger, faster, and stronger than humans. They've been using armor probably since they were little. We still don't have enough real experience for me to be confident of our chances in this one. That bugger with the explosives is the real problem. That's where we could use our suits. Go in high speed and hit him before he can react. We can't do that if we need our suits to engage those two leaders. Somehow we need to make that laborer disarm those explosives, or distract him even a short time, make him hesitate." He looked up at me. "You have another magic trick up your sleeve, sir." "I wish I did," I said, shaking my head slowly. Magic is what we needed right then. The Spec Ops people were committed and brave, willing to go in and accomplish the mission regardless of the cost to themselves. Willing to go in if I ordered them to. An order I didn't want to give. It wouldn't be right for me to send them into a straight, brutal firefight simply because their commander couldn't think of a better tactical solution to the problem. Yet, we'd come this far. We couldn't simply give up now. A magic trick would be a great thing to have right then. All magic is based on deception. I sucked in a sharp breath. "Captain Smythe, I have an idea. Skippy, you listening?"
"I'm here," Skippy acknowledged. With an attentive audience, I explained my plan. Smythe grinned appreciatively.
"Sir, I think Skippy is right. You are an evil genius."
I had to laugh at that, despite the seriousness of the situation.
"This will work?"
The Spec Ops people were the experts on what they could accomplish and not.
"Oh, yes. We'll handle it from here, sir," Smythe said, and turned to sketch out an attack plan in the mud.
Phase 3 Bravo, that I dreamed up on the spot, began by Skippy transmitting over the radio. The message was supposedly from the Krustang who had shot down the Luzzard and the dropship and stolen the Elder Power Tap. Pretending to be one of those Krustang from the Red Stone Clan, Skippy made a plea to the laborer with the explosives. He explained that the Red Stone Clan ship had never truly jumped away. It had been hiding behind a stealth field in orbit the whole time. The Red Stone Clan had given the security access codes to the laborers, and if the one remaining Krustang laborer deactivated the explosives and joined the Red Stone, he could split the reward. Our two men in armored suits stepped over the ridge into clear view and began running toward the storehouse where the laborer was holed up with the Elder AI, the precious comm node, and a pile of explosives. 3 Bravo worked, because the three remaining Krustang heard Krustang talking to them and saw two unfamiliar Krustang armored suits pop up and run toward the base. The scavengers were alone on Newark, as far as they knew. They believed our story about the Red Stone Clan instantly, because that was the only possible explanation, based on what the scavengers knew. They had no reason to think the two Krustang armored suits running toward the base contained anyone other than Krustang from the Red Stone Clan. To think anything else right then would be absurd. Our deception worked as intended. The two leaders in armor screeched angrily over the radio and stepped out from behind cover to race toward the armory, intending to get there before the two Red Stone Clan in armor suits could. From where they were, the two leaders couldn't get a clear shot at our two armored warriors. Several buildings were between the two pairs of combatants, and our men weaved as they ran, using low spots in the hill slope to keep out of plain sight. The Spec Ops teams had practiced this broken field running in suits many times. Skippy's opinion was that because of the size gap between humans and Kristang and the different running gaits of the two species, a human wearing armor would look strange to a Kristang, and any Kristang would notice something wrong fairly quickly. With our two men running down the hill slope, leaping from cover to cover, they weren't clearly visible long enough for the Kristang to tell those armored suits didn't contain Kristang. Or so we hoped. The two scavenger leaders were not making any attempt to keep to cover, racing at the full, amazing speed their suits could manage. They were fast. Almost too fast. Our entire assault team, except the alpha team of two men in armor and one rifleman waiting for a clear shot at the laborer, had our Kristang rifles sighted in on the scavenger leaders, and even with advanced knowledge of how fast beings in suits could run and the super technology of Kristang adaptive gun sights, most of our first volley of shots missed. Enough shots did hit the two scavenger leaders that they went down quickly, stumbling and falling, skidding across the ground. Now alert to the danger, they separated and attempted to get behind cover. They were too late. Massed fire with 8 to 10 rifles concentrating on each set of armor knocked them back down again, and our explosive-tipped, armor-penetrating rounds began to bite through the tough armor.
"Cease fire! Cease fire!" Skippy shouted over the private channel. "Stop shooting! Those two are dead! You're wasting ammo!"
Before I had to say anything, we all stopped shooting at the two now-inert Kristang leaders. Our two men in armor didn't hesitate. They kept running toward the armory building. This was the moment of maximum danger. If that lizard in the armory decided he had nothing to lose and detonated the explosives, we could lose our two men in suits, the comm node, and the AI. I was about to order the two men in suits to halt so we could try talking to the remaining Kristang, but the sharp crack of a rifle interrupted me. The sniper we had assigned to cover the armory had not lost focus for a second, despite the gunfire ringing out all around him. The massed fire had attracted the attention of the laborer in the armory. Curiosity, or maybe the fear of not knowing what is going on, overcame his better judgment, and he popped his head up for a quick look. Not quick enough. A sniper from the Chinese team drilled him once in the head with an explosive-tipped round, and that was the end of it. Fortunately, the laborer hadn't rigged up any kind of dead man switch on the explosives, because nothing further happened.
"You certain you got him?" I asked the sniper.
"Yes, sir," he said, and transmitted his gun scope camera image to my Z-phone. There was no question about it. The lizard's head had exploded like... Well, I'll spare you the unpleasant details. What mattered was that lizard, it wasn't going to be a problem for anyone ever again. "Alpha team," I ordered the two men in suits. "Approach with caution. Everyone else hold position." We waited while the alpha team and their armor carefully leapfrogged toward the armory. This was a situation where I wish we had the full suite of Kristang infantry fighting gear, especially recon drones. We could have launched a drone into the armory without risking anyone's life to get us all the intel we needed. As it was, with only two armored suits and no recon gear, we made do with what we had. One, then both of the alpha team disappeared inside the large door of the armory. Then one of them came outside and waved to me.
"All clear, sir. No booby traps. He would have had to manually set off the explosives. Looks like he was mostly bluffing."
"Skippy," I inquired, "what do you think?"
"I concur. All is clear. None of the Kristang are alive."
"Damn." I breathed a sigh of relief. "We did it. We actually did it." Smythe saved his weapon, stood up, and crisply saluted me.
"Sir, we destroyed their air power and neutralized all of them without a single shot being fired in our direction. This is the most successful operation I've ever been involved in. That was a hell of a plan, sir."
"So far, Captain. So far." We still needed to hide from the Kristang ship that would arrive before the Dutchman was ready, then later get off the planet safely. "Let's secure Skippy's magic radio and the AI, and then I'll think about celebrating somewhat."
Chapter 26. The Elder gear we wanted was in a pile on the floor of the armory, underneath a dead lizard. I ordered the Alpha team to remove the dead Kristang, as the 7-foot-tall body was too heavy for me to move by myself. It took a few minutes of sorting through the pile to find the two things Skippy sought, the AI and the comm node. The comm node I found first. It was in a box surrounded by padding. The Kristang must have recognized it as something at least semi-valuable.
Okay, we have the comm node.
No, Skippy interrupted me.
The AI. Find the AI.
All right, I assured him. Looking for it now. Setting aside the comm node, the magic radio we had come all the way.